Hello, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, Chief Medical Officer of the American Lung Association. Welcome to Lungcast. This month's discussion is about respiratory virus immunizations. When looking at the history of vaccines timeline, you can start in 15th century China. The Chinese recognized that people who survived smallpox did not get the disease again. They decided to take smallpox scabs from people who had mild cases, dry them out, grind them into a powder, and blow the powder up the nostrils of healthy people. The effectiveness of these early vaccination efforts is not well known, but they seem to have had the right idea, taking a weaker version of the virus and introducing it to healthy people to allow them to have their immune systems build up antibodies to fight off the virus. Edward Jenner is considered the founder of vaccinology here in the West. In 1796, he inoculated a 13-year-old boy with vaccinia virus, or cowpox, a relative of smallpox, and he demonstrated immunity to smallpox. In 1798, the first smallpox vaccine was developed, and as a result, systematic implementation of mass smallpox immunizations ultimately led to its global eradication in 1979. Now, despite the evidence of health gains from immunization programs, there has always been resistance to vaccines in some groups. The late 1970s and 1980s marked a period of increasing legal issues concerning vaccine side effects, leading to a decline in the number of companies actually researching and producing vaccines. This unfortunate situation was corrected to some degree with the implementation of the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program in the United States in 1986. However, the legacy of this era of concern lives on today, sometimes marked by supply crises as well as continued media efforts by a growing vocal anti-vaccination lobby. The past two decades have seen the application of molecular genetics and its increased insights into immunology, microbiology, and genomics applied to vaccinology. Current successes include the development of new vaccines for hepatitis B, pertussis, and new techniques for seasonal influenza vaccine manufacture. Very importantly, our current pandemic, molecular genetics set the scene for a rapid effective vaccine for COVID-19 through the use of mRNA and viral vector techniques, among others. So today's discussion about respiratory virus immunizations comes at a time when the subject was possibly never, has never meant more for this country. Full vaccination rates for COVID-19 have failed to reach desirable levels as vaccine hesitancy, often due to misinformation and other factors, has set in. This is at a time when the highly transmissible Delta variant has driven surges of new cases, hospitalizations and deaths among states and regions with low vaccination rates. FDA, CDC, and World Health Organization experts have been deliberating on the utility of COVID-19 vaccine booster doses for this fall. And actually, at the time of this recording, the White House is beginning a push for booster vaccinations to be available later in September to all eligible Americans 8 months after their initial vaccination occurred. For too many months now, the COVID-19 pandemic and the discussion around vaccines has dominated the news cycle, and rightly so. However, as we are airing this Lungcast episode during National Immunization Awareness Month, I want to make sure we discuss the other important respiratory pathogens that I've been dealing with over many years, and how the development of therapies, including vaccines, has changed the outlook for these diseases. We know, however, just like with COVID-19, the vaccines don't help if people don't use them. Joining me today are two experts with diverse backgrounds in infectious disease and pharmaceutical development who can speak to the rapidly evolving matters of respiratory virus vaccination. Dr. Michael Greenberg is the Vice President and Regional Medical Head of Sanofi Pasteur North America. A former pediatrician, Dr. Greenberg served in the CDC's Epidemic Intelligence Service before turning to vaccine development work in the private sector, just in time to assist in developing one of the first vaccines for the H1N1 flu virus. Dr. Rick Nettles is the lead of U.S. Infectious Disease and Vaccine Medical Affairs at the Janssen Pharmaceutical Companies of Johnson & Johnson.
Dr. Nettles has worked, his work has entailed a wide spectrum of infectious disease clinical development, from HIV therapies to his company's investigational COVID-19 vaccines. We hope you enjoy and learn from our timely conversation with this industry leaders. So let's start with influenza. We've already seen that influenza cases rates were significantly decreased during the COVID pandemic, probably related to the mitigation efforts used to stop the spread of the SARS-CoV-2 virus. Do you have some thoughts on how this next flu season will look and how you can clarify if the process for determining the strains of influenza vaccines utilized and ultimately effectiveness of the vaccine will be impacted by the low rates of influenza in the Southern Hemisphere this past year?
Thank you, Dr. Rizzo. It's a pleasure to be here. As you said, not only do we see a low rate of influenza in the Southern Hemisphere, in fact, last year was probably the most unusual flu season we've seen since keeping records, where circulation of flu was barely detectable globally. There was certainly plenty of testing, but positivity rates were in the range of about 0.2%. And just compare that with rates of about 25 to 30%. That were seen among the tests that were done in the 3 years prior to the pandemic. So as for what to expect this year, well, I think having a crystal ball would probably be an asset, but, you know, to say that it's uncertain is probably, an underestimate. I think there are probably a few ways this could go. It could remain low, as we saw last year. And a lot of that will depend on how we maintain the non-pharmaceutical interventions like masking, social distancing, and hand washing, which, in addition to things like decreased global travel and school closures, are likely the main factors that drove down flu last year. If not, we could certainly see influenza come back with a vengeance, especially since we had no natural boosting due to that absent circulation, and therefore the potential buildup of susceptibility in the population. And this could happen during the regular flu season, during the months we typically see flu, or could even be seen in atypical months, much like the RSV epidemic that we're seeing in many parts of the US right now.
Dr. Nettles, anything to add?
No, I agree. We are living in a time that is very hard to predict. And I agree that the mitigating steps that we've taken to protect the population from COVID have had an impact in protecting us at least temporarily from RSV and from influenza. And it's very hard to predict what will happen when we remove those mitigating steps.
I think Dr. Greenberg touched on this a bit, but can you both discuss the recent unseasonable spike in RSV that's been occurring throughout the country, and especially in the Southeast? And what were some of your thoughts on how that's developed as a result of the COVID pandemic?
Yeah, I could say a word or two about respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV. This is a respiratory infection that's less well known among the non-medical community. Even though that it's less well known, it is a very serious condition that is one of the leading causes of pneumonia and bronchitis in individuals. It's most well known for causing very severe disease in the very young, neonates in particular. But what is less well appreciated is that it also causes very severe disease in those individuals who are older, or those who are having some other condition which makes them at risk for more severe disease, such as concomitant COPD, pulmonary diseases, or cardiac diseases. Unfortunately, it's less well appreciated because testing is not often done and is often confused with other respiratory infections such as influenza. Just as Dr. Greenberg mentioned, because we have been using these mitigating techniques, staying out of school, wearing masks, extensive hand washing, there was a period over the last 18 months where natural infection with RSV has not been happening. Unfortunately, that results in individuals who have less natural immunity to RSV. And as we've returned to our normal daily activities, RSV has seemed to be surging first across the South. And that was recognized by a health alert put out by the CDC. And now we see it's surging in other parts of the United States, unfortunately.
I think in addition to what, all the great points that Dr. Nettles made, certainly we see the burden of RSV, not only in the elderly, but also, as was mentioned, in infants, and really has the potential to cause disease in all infants. In fact, most babies will get RSV by the time they're about 2 years old. But what we've seen is that, as this circulates, out of the typical season, we have to ask, why is RSV coming back and flu hasn't? And I don't think we have a full understanding of that. Some of that may be due to the different types of transmission patterns we see with RSV, particularly being transmitted from older siblings to younger siblings who are naive, but also the fact that among the earlier institutions to open were daycare centers and preschools, where we know that there's a lot more RSV circulation. There are also thoughts about the potential for interference between different viruses and whether there's a differential impact between, say, SARS-CoV-2 and influenza compared with SARS-CoV-2 and respiratory syncytial virus. But I think we don't really understand it, but it's certainly something that needs to be investigated further.
It was certainly one of the points from the CDC is to encourage broader testing so that we do fully understand what severe respiratory infection we're dealing with when we're presented, whether that be influenza, RSV, or COVID.
I found this on the list. Yeah.
An interesting side note, I was on a call today at my institution, and they're starting to see, as compared to last fall when they were doing the respiratory virus isolations, they weren't seeing as much of the other normal viruses. But this year, we're seeing more of the RSV and the adenovirus is being picked up in the swabs that are being done. So I think that does point to maybe got to see a little bit more of those viruses being present and hopefully recognizing them as such and not just assuming COVID is the primary pathogen. My next couple of questions have to do with kind of tied in with the fact this time of year it's back to school time, and certainly it's hard to not turn on the TV or listen to the radio before you start hearing ideas about masking and schools, mandating school masks, but also the concern about the unvaccinated 11-year-old and younger. How do you foresee, and I know we don't have a crystal ball again for this, but what are some of your concerns based on your expertise with regard to school-age children this time of year going back to school, especially the unvaccinated?
Fortunately, what we're seeing is that clinical trials continue to advance, looking at vaccination in children. And as you know, vaccines now are available for those down to 12 years of age, and we hope that that vaccines will be available in the near future for children who are even younger. At Janssen, we certainly understand that there's a huge unmet medical need here. We have multiple clinical trials that we're in discussions with health authorities around the world to extend the use of the Janssen COVID-19 vaccine down to the age of 12. So that adolescent population, that's certainly important. But that doesn't help a parent who's about to send their child to school or who started in the last week or two. And the best that advice that I've heard is advice given from the CDC, which is around doing everything that you can to protect the unvaccinated by making sure that those who are eligible for vaccination are vaccinated. And really cocooning the individuals who aren't able to receive a vaccination by protecting in every way you can aside from vaccination. So vaccinating the adults, making sure that you follow health instruction from the CDC in your community around wearing masks and such.
Certainly, we're all very hopeful that there will be the opportunity to vaccinate kids under the age of 12, as those trials conclude and the data are available. But we're certainly seeing the number of kids being infected with COVID-19 soaring at the moment, particularly with this new highly contagious Delta variant. As schools reopen, I think everybody's concerned that this could potentially push hospitals around the country to have even less capacity than what they're already facing. So, and we know that among the kids who are getting hospitalized with COVID-19, about half of them have underlying medical conditions. That means the other half were previously healthy. So it really dispels the myth that I think is prevalent in the general community that COVID-19 is no big deal in the pediatric population. So I think certainly the availability of the safe and effective vaccines in this age group are going to be, you know, the key to controlling it. But obviously, you know, as Dr. Nettles pointed out, as you pointed out, we need to continue to maintain the barrier methods, the masking and social distancing for those kids who can't be who aren't yet eligible for vaccination. And just as a parent, I mean, I'm fortunate. Both of my teenage boys are over the age of 12, and you know, my whole family's been vaccinated. But I see a lot of people out, parents with their under 12-year-old kids, where the child's required to wear a mask because of not having been vaccinated yet. But the parent walks around, you know, ideally, you know, presumably vaccinated, not wearing a mask. And I think even if that's not necessarily, you know, the routine recommendation, I think just showing solidarity with the kids by also wearing a mask, knowing that they're not, that they don't have to do it themselves, could probably go a long way. But I would say the other thing is, even as we do get, you know, vaccines, hopefully for kids under the age of 12 and even in the older pediatric population, you know, another area is going to be making sure that those COVID vaccines actually get into the provider offices versus the mass vaccination clinics, which have been the mainstay up until now. Now, they have been important in getting kids vaccinated. That's where I took my kids. But we know that office-based vaccination is going to continue to be important, not only for COVID-19, but also to make sure that, you know, that the routine pediatric care and the other childhood immunizations that are important at this back-to-school time are also tended to.
Thank you. That actually leads into my next question. It's going to switch gears a little bit. As a pulmonologist, I'm very aware, and I stress to my patients that their chronic lung disease puts them at risk for flares from many respiratory viruses, as well as bacterial infections. We have vaccines to help combat two of those pathogens, particularly pertussis and pneumococcus. Unfortunately, the rate of adult immunization in general, let alone among individuals with chronic lung disease, still is unacceptably low, especially for pertussis. Can you comment on some of the reasons and potential steps to improve the situation for these two available vaccines?
Sure. Well, I think there are several reasons why pertussis-containing vaccines such as Tdap may be underused in adults. One is really around the low awareness of the disease, as well as the low index of suspicion among many healthcare providers, particularly in adults, because of the, you know, the lack of the typical manifestations that may be seen, say, in pertussis in infants with the classic, you know, whooping cough. So for many years, pertussis has been considered a childhood disease. But we know that adults obviously get it too, and in particular, individuals with asthma and COPD are especially vulnerable, as we know that pertussis is one of the organisms that can be associated with exacerbations. I think another reason is that there are many missed opportunities to vaccinate. So, for example, we know that Tdap vaccine could be co-administered with an influenza vaccine. However, many people go to get their flu vaccine at their provider, but there's no routine review of their other recommended vaccines, included their Tdap status. And so that's one missed opportunity. So clearly that, stronger recommendations from healthcare providers will do a lot to be able to increase pertussis vaccination in this age group. And we know that the CDC strongly recommends pertussis and pneumococcal vaccines for individuals with lung disease, including asthma.
Dr. Nettles?
Well, I think COVID has certainly given us the opportunity to learn about the barriers to vaccinating the adult population. And you can't turn on the TV today and watch the news without it being debated. I think some of the things that we've learned is we need to make sure that the trusted individuals for patients are informed. And oftentimes those are the healthcare workers or the pharmacists who the patient are going to interact with. So we as healthcare providers need to make sure that we are maximally informed and that our recommendations are clear and unambiguous. Patients value our opinions above others in this regard. And the second then is removing any barriers to vaccination. So as Dr. Greenberg said, make it as convenient as possible, making sure that patients are informed, making sure that they have access without barriers to the extent possible around copay or logistic concerns around needing to travel far for the vaccine. I think those are the things that we're certainly learning from COVID.
Yeah, you read my mind on my next question. A lot of polls look at who individuals trust with regard to their health. And repeatedly, physicians, their healthcare providers are often near the top of that list. So for the physicians who are listening today, could you explain a little bit what may help them be more knowledgeable for their patients with regard to how these vaccines were developed? I know there was concern with the Operation Warp Speed, whether or not this was really something that was done appropriately at a pace that the science allowed. Maybe explain what went into the development of these vaccines that are available. And then also what the importance of difference between EUA versus full approval by the FDA, ACIP, and CDC, how that plays a role. It's a long question and a lot in there, but if you could give your opinions on that.
I can start on this one. I think the first important point for healthcare providers to know is that with many of the vaccines we see emerging with COVID, the underlying platforms that the vaccines were being developed from have actually been in development for decades. So as an example, the Janssen COVID-19 vaccine relies on an adenovirus-based platform, and that's not a new technology. We have been using that technology, as I said, for more than a decade, and we've developed an Ebola vaccine with that platform that's approved in Europe. So we weren't starting from scratch in this regard. But the second point is that these vaccines have been through very, very large clinical trials. They've gone through the usual development steps of a phase 1 clinical trial, a phase 2 clinical trial, where we expand the size of the population. And then the phase 3 clinical trials with these COVID vaccines were actually quite large compared to the typical vaccine trials. And I think you'd all agree that they were done with a degree of transparency and scrutiny that is unlike anything we've seen before. And so the eyes on these trials, the size of the trials should be reassuring to healthcare providers and to patients. We have found ways to accelerate getting these vaccines to patients by doing things such as producing the vaccine in parallel at risk while the phase 3 clinical trial was ongoing. But there were no shortcuts with regard to the size of the trial or the review process by the FDA or the CDC. Those have followed the normal processes. It's simply been a matter of more collaboration and intense effort that has allowed us to move these things forward quickly.
I think, Dr. Nettles, you covered the role of the FDA, quite well in terms of what they've done, what they do in terms of the approval of vaccines through all the steps. Maybe I can touch a bit on the role of the CDC and the ACIP. So obviously the CDC has many roles, but specific to immunizations, they provide guidance how best to use the vaccines so there can be a uniform approach throughout the country across different medical settings. So they enlist a group of experts who meet frequently and debate data in the open. So these are experts engaged by the CDC. It's a very transparent process, and they vote on recommendations for use of a vaccine or immunization. So the CDC uses the advice of the experts on the ACIP, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practice, to issue its formal guidance to which medical practices across the U.S. and, to be honest, across the world really follow. So it's important to note that the ACIP continues to evaluate data over time. They continue to revisit their recommendations. So it's not just a one-time deliberation, but really an ongoing review with updates to those recommendations as the data warrant, so that we have the best medical thinking applied for use in our public health system.
We know that the COVID pandemic shined a light on disparities in this country, showing that underserved populations and communities of color were experiencing higher levels of hospitalization and death in many areas of the country related to the COVID infection. This seems to be a result of many of the social determinants of health and access that are inequitable and some are from cultural beliefs and mistrust of the medical establishment. Can you comment on your experience based on whether or not these disparities may have been present related to non-COVID infections prior to this? And what do you see with regard to the future likelihood that immunization rates could be improved in this population, not only for COVID, obviously, but for other respiratory pathogens?
You said it well. I think COVID has shined a light on a problem that has existed long before COVID. So disparities, inequities in our healthcare system certainly were uncovered with COVID. We know that the percentage of individuals who've died are greater in the African American and the Hispanic community as compared to the overall percentage who've died. And so this is certainly not a new problem and something that has existed, and something that we as a healthcare community and as a company that I speak for, J&J, we take this very seriously, and it's a public health issue that we need to do better on moving forward.
I couldn't agree more. Certainly the increased awareness that the pandemic has raised on this issue is really focused a lot of much needed attention to improve the access, to improve equitable access within communities. And I think there are a number of reasons behind this that will inform how we can go about doing this. So certainly education is one aspect of it, but it's not just that. It's really also a lot of it's around trust. And so many of the ongoing approaches are really about engaging with the communities, particularly the trusted leaders in communities who can then set the stage for improving immunization rates, dispelling many of the myths that may be prevalent among some communities, not only for, in the fight against COVID-19, but other respiratory diseases and vaccine preventable diseases. Just to give you an example related to flu, there was a study published recently by Mahmoud et al. In Lancet that looked at in U.S. Medicare recipients, if you're a Black or Brown American, you're not only about 30% less likely to get a flu vaccine in the first place, but you're also, even if you do get a flu vaccine, you're still about 30% less likely to get a high-dose vaccine as typically used in this over 65 population. So, and this is after controlling for factors such as education, geography, health insurance status. So at least to me, what this tells us is that there remain important biases and other systemic factors that are there. They may be overt, they may be latent, but in the end, it can lead to a dual standard of care, including where vaccination is concerned, based on the color of one's skin. And that's just not okay. We have to do better.
Well said by both of you. Yeah. So the COVID pandemic changed our lives in many ways. I know the field of telemedicine exploded, and it's now in prime time, and it's here to stay most likely. And the science of mRNA vaccines sped ahead to provide life-saving vaccines. My last question will have you both look into your crystal balls. Based on your experience in the field and your current role as in a major manufacturer of vaccines, what do you see as far as breakthroughs in research that we may look for, either in the field of immunizations in general or for specific pathogens in the years to come?
There's no doubt we've seen advances in vaccine technologies. I think the one that everyone's most familiar with is the use of mRNA as a platform for delivering vaccines, but we've seen the advance in other vaccine technologies as well, which not only have the potential to shorten vaccine development timelines, as Dr. Nettles referred to earlier, but also to target pathogens that have not been able to be vaccine preventable in the past due to the difficulty in developing a successful vaccine. I think another area where we've seen an explosion has been in the application of digital health, something that I've been interested in for at least the last 10 years, but which is really starting to come to the mainstream, including the use of artificial intelligence. Where we've really seen this moving the needle is in areas like antigen design, finding efficiencies in the R&D process, as well as the application of technology for decentralized clinical trials that have the potential to expand clinical research beyond the traditional trial sites and tertiary care centers into communities and even in homes where people live. So for me, those are two examples. Beyond the technology, I think there's also been an unprecedented level of cooperation between different companies. Dr. Nettles and I think have shared the stage more than once during this pandemic. And I think the kind of collaboration communication between industry partners and between industry and government has really been exemplary, such as our alliance with GSK to develop a recombinant protein-based vaccine with their adjuvant, as well as the rapid sharing of data between institutions. So, and I think that, that kind of cooperation is something that we'd certainly like to see continue.
Yeah, I can speak to a couple of additional points. I think really unprecedented transparency has evolved during the COVID-19 pandemic. It has become the norm now to make full clinical trial protocols available online for anyone to read the full clinical trial, not just posting of the title on clinicaltrials.gov, and putting in place mechanisms to monitor the enrollment of clinical trials to ensure that the diversity of the population matches the diversity of the population in the U.S. Those are some examples of really powerful tools that I hope we don't lose after the pandemic recedes. And finally, I'd say and this touches on something we were talking about before, what has become apparent is we're not great at making sure that adults are up to speed with all the vaccinations that could benefit their health. And so finding a better way to equitably distribute vaccinations in the adult population and to being able to track that so that people understand which vaccines they got a decade ago versus those that they've forgotten that they haven't gotten. I think those are really important areas that now we know are critically important, and probably solutions can come forward in those areas to help us do better.
We've covered a lot of area here and certainly have whet the appetite for people to talk more about this and look into this a little bit more. Some good, interesting ideas about what the future holds as well. Any closing comments from either of you before we wrap this up?
I'd just like to thank those who are listening to the podcast, for frontline healthcare providers. It's been an incredible year, and thank you for all you do.
Yeah, hear, hear. I couldn't agree more. I would say, one thing that the pandemic has done is really raised the national awareness of the value and importance of immunizations, and people have engaged with the medical system probably more than ever in their lifetimes in order to get a vaccine. I think the opportunity and the challenge that we have before us is really make sure that we continue to engage the public to make full use of the prevention measures, including immunizations, but beyond that, in order to help people live healthier lives. And so we're grateful for the opportunity to be with you on this podcast, the great work that the American Lung Association and all of the healthcare providers, Dr. Nettles, gave a shout out to. Grateful for all the work you're doing, and thank you for the opportunity.
Very good. Thank you both.
Thank you again to Drs. Greenberg and Nettles for providing a lay of the rapidly changing land of respiratory virus immunizations. It's fascinating and ever important to learn in what ways the research extends beyond the daily headlines of COVID-19 vaccination. If you enjoyed this interview, be sure to check out previous Lungcast episodes, including our COVID-19 discussions with Dr. Anthony Fauci, Dr. David Ho, and more, all available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and other major podcast platforms. For additional news and insights into respiratory health, be sure to visit us at hcplive.com and lung.org. Until next month, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, reminding you that if you can't breathe, nothing else matters, so just take it one breath at a time.